Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com. /awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
From Night Sky Productions World Headquarters overlooking the glamorous San Fernando Valley, I'm Mick Garris, and this is Postmortem. Horror is the perfect platform for the anthology film. Horror anthologies have been a passion of mine since spending my childhood watching The Twilight Zone, One Step Beyond, Thriller, The Outer Limits, and so many others. It's also where I got my start as a screenwriter on Steven Spielberg's less horrific Amazing Stories, but you can guess who was usually involved in the scary ones. I've worked on Amazing Stories, Freddy's Nightmares, and Tales from the Crypt before creating my own Masters of Horror series and the Nightmare Cinema feature film. The anthology feature, though, is in some ways more exciting because more often than not, it is created by several cinematic voices in one package. Harking back to Dead of Night in 1947 and Spirits of the Dead in 1968, several masters of the language of cinema have banded together to showcase unique and varying styles in one package. The trend continues with the VHS movies, ABCs of Death, XX, Southbound, and countless others. With Masters of Horror and Nightmare Cinema, I wanted to showcase films and filmmakers from different cultures, bringing directors from Italy, the UK, Japan, Cuba, and elsewhere to give our audience a taste of something they might not have been exposed to before. Two of my collaborators on Nightmare Cinema, Alejandro Brugues, born in Argentina and raised in Cuba, and Salvador and Mike Mendez, are part of a brand new horror anthology film focusing on Latino culture. The new movie, Satanic Hispanics, with Gigi Sol Guerrero, Damian Rugna, and Eduardo Sanchez, also on board as writer-directors, they've brought something new to the game. It's an opportunity for the rest of the world to enter the sanguinary world of Latin horror. Mike and Alejandro are here to share how this came to be and how our beloved genre is universal. Gentlemen, good to be back together with you. It's like a Nightmare Cinema reunion here. Producer Joe and Mike, you edited the movie. Alejandro did one of the segments. It's like a party.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's great to be here. I mean, you know, I feel like we are a cousin of Nightmare Cinema. We feel like we're some like kind of lost sibling.
The Latino
here.
Cousin.
The Latino cousin. Yes, exactly. Yes.
Well, you've done this before as a producer. You and Axel Carolyn produced Tales from Halloween.
Right.
And so tell me how that got together and how that and maybe working on Nightmare Cinema led to Satanic Hispanics.
Well, I think like yourself, who's, you know, loves anthology films, just I really enjoy working with other filmmakers. And that is something I got through working with you and Nightmare Cinema, working with Alejandro Nightmare Cinema. Like, what an honor. I mean, that was a great experience to work with Joe Dante and yourself. And, you know, that was awesome. And then in Tales of Halloween, we had a very similar thing of like, okay, we have the LA crew. Let's kind of just make movies with our friends and do something with the LA community. So I just enjoy it. It can go bad, I'm sure, but I really think it's important in choosing the correct filmmakers that you're going to collaborate with. that I've really had a pleasant experience so far with it. I just love doing it. So basically the backstory is, we had made Tales of Halloween with Epic Pictures, and I was just in the mood to do another one. I just like, okay, I'd like to do it, but needed as you mentioned, all this great, you know, history of anthology films, everything's been done. You can't just like, hey, we're getting a bunch of filmmakers and just doing a thing unless you have a point of view or something to say, you know, between VHS, between Diver Cinema, between Mortuary Collection. It's like, it's very well covered stuff. So I was like, I don't want to do this unless it hasn't been done before and it's something unique. And was really kind of racking my brain thinking about it. And then one day Alejandro said, when the fuck are we making Satanic Hispanics, the Latino horror anthology? And it just clicked. I was like, you're right. When the fuck are we making Satanic Hispanics, the horror anthology? So from there it was like, okay, let's do it. Who do you think we could get that would be realistic to us? And then we approached Epic Pictures and they were, you know, on board. So, and here we are.
Owners of Dread. Exactly. Podcast network hosts. Yeah. Yes. So Ale, you were the one who lit the match?
He likes to say that. I swear, I'm not sure. I swear that it was like a combined stupidity effort.
Which most things we do are.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, you have seen us working together. You know that when Mike and I are working and there's some like really stupid idea, it makes it into the film.
it usually said like this, like, that is so stupid, we have to do it.
Yeah, it's like, let's go, let's do it. I just had a dumb idea, let's do it. And this was certainly one of those cases. We enjoyed a lot working together in Nightmare Cinema. It was like, you know, nice to be hanging out and making something, and we wanted to
and speaking
repeat.
In a language nobody else could understand.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that wouldn't be Spanish. In that language would be dumb shit.
Dumb shit.
That's what Mike and I talk.
Very fluent in dumb shit. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're very fluent, and this is going great already. And then, yeah. Apparently, I said, "Why don't we make an all Latino anthology and call it Satanic Hispanics?" And like, literally, we were like saying, "Okay, this would be great. Who could be the people that we bring?" We wanted to bring friends, because what's the point of doing this if we're not having fun?
Nobody's
friends?
Making money. So
yeah, exactly, right. Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah. And I also learned that from you. Like, let's do this with friends. So immediately, I thought about Eduardo Sanchez, because we had met while doing From Dusk Till Dawn. He's also Cuban, and we were on the phone, and I was texting Ed and telling him we're making an anthology called Satanic Hispanics and you're in it.
and it worked.
He was probably lying in his backyard or something, looked at the text, and he went and he replied, okay. and then as soon as we hung up, Mike texted Gigi.
Yeah.
With the same, like a cryptic text, according to Gigi, Satanic Hispanics, what do you think?
Now that I don't remember, but you know,
that sounds very Mike.
Yeah, I'll trust her words. Now, to be fair, like the term Satanic Hispanics, we used it. I would produce these heavy metal videos for this wonderful makeup effects artist who did our effects called Norman Cabrera, and we happened to have a Latino DP. He was Cuban, I was Salvadorian, and so we would make these videos and we'd go, yeah, the Satanic Hispanics. So that term would be bantied about. And he just had the idea of like, yes, let's make that a film, you know.
Well, it sounds like a prepackaged thing that's ready to go.
Yeah,
who
totally
would turn down Satanic Hispanics?
Well, there is the Boycott Satanic Hispanics, online right now. There's 11 signatures. We're encouraging people to sign it.
So yeah.
Somebody out there, I don't know if I should bring that up. I don't think I don't care. Somebody out there felt this movie is racist. It makes Hispanics look like Satanists and occultists. That it must be made by Trumpers.
Obviously, they've seen the film.
Obviously,
yeah, absolutely. And I mean, he only has 11 signatures, yeah. But that's because all the witchcraft we're doing to him is working. Like the moment we read that, I was like, Mike, bring out the chickens.
But that was the thing. It hadn't been done before. It just felt like, why is that? We watch so many genre films, and you have, you know, all sorts of cultures, and Latinos are like the number one audience for horror films. But it's like, how come there's hardly any that are for Latinos? And when they do, they feel very pandering. Right. You know, they're always talking about tacos and things like that.
No, but I do have, I mean, I have several answers for that. I don't think it's been for lack of trying.
Okay.
Because I know people in Latin America that has been trying to do it, but in Latin America, like, getting a movie made, a genre movie made, is so hard that I don't think they have gained the traction. And when they had, it's been in stuff like Mexico Barbaro, which, I mean, it's all Latinos, but it's Mexico.
The appeal is very specifically to a Mexican.
Yeah, it's just to Mexico.
It's a really good film.
Yeah, but that's a problem. And our idea was, like, the moment we thought about it was like, okay, if we're doing this, if we're gonna showcase Hispanic talent in behind and in front of the camera, we should try to go as wide as possible. Like, we had first generation Americans like Mike, we had immigrants like me, like Ed, like Gigi, in her case lives in Canada, but we also wanted people that still lived in Latin America, which is why we went for the Mian Runa, because we all love Terrified. It's a fantastic movie.
Yeah.
Big fans.
I think we're probably the first then, because we were just the cheapest.
I don't think so. I don't think so. I'm pretty sure. I mean, that's relative, you know, because it's not the same to be the cheapest here than the cheapest in Argentina, sure. Because it's probably the same amount of money, but it's harder to raise their money like that for a genre film. And
I met him in Argentina.
He's a piece of shit, right?
Everyone is lovely. They're all amazing.
He's lovely. I had to bully Damian, you know.
And he's not lying. He really did bully Damian.
I had to be his therapist and then his bully, because at first,
which he excels at both those.
I'm fantastic at that.
Yeah.
But like
Dr. Bruguet.
Yeah.
Exactly. First, I called him. Like, I didn't know Damian. I got his phone number, and I had just landed in Vancouver to shoot Mr. Joe Russo screenplay,
The Inheritance. We'll talk about that.
And while I was in quarantine, still at the airport, like, the first thing I did while I was unpacking is I called Damian and I said, "We're making this anthology. It's me, Eduardo, Mike, and Gigi, and we want you to be in it." And Damian was like, "Well, I would love to. I just don't know because I'm very busy. I have this movie I want to make," and I'm like, "I'm not asking you. I'm telling you, you're gonna be in it. We're gonna figure out the timing and all that." And time was passing, and we kept in touch, and he was always like, "Well, I don't know, my movie and all that." And I'm like, "You have time to do both." And then he had these other commitments here. And he was like, "I don't know if I'm gonna be able to." And I'm gonna personally talk to the producers of those movies and say, "Give me Damian for 4 days." And then he was shooting his movie, and we had a deadline, and he was the last one to shoot. And we were like, when can you do it?" And he was like, "I don't think I can, because I'm finishing my movie, and then I want to take a month off before I dive into this." And I said to him, "Why the fuck do you want to take a month off? You're already shooting. Keep shooting. Yeah. You have the crew. You have everything. Shoot back to back." And he was like, "You know what? That's a good idea." And that's how he did it. So I literally had to bully him.
I was honestly waiting at any moment for Damian to go, "You know what? Fuck yourself. I don't have time to do it. I've told you 40 times I don't have time to do it. You keep pushing." I was waiting for it.
He's such a nice guy that he didn't say that to me.
And then he kicked the shit out of it. That was the other thing. Yeah. You know, like he blew us away. It was kind of like, he might have done better than us.
I like him. I think I honestly think it's one of the best segments.
It was awesome. And then he only revealed recently that he wrote it like 2 weeks before shooting it. It was really, he had a vague idea that we could play with, so we could do the wraparound and stuff like that. And then he would like to change the character's name, and we were like, no, we shot it as Gustavo. We introduced a guy named Gustavo. You have to make it a Gustavo. And he came through. He just did an awesome job. He's such a talented guy. And then that other movie he finished just got into Toronto, so it'll be showing here at Beyond Fest.
Well, the festival experience is a really important thing. I mean, your first movie, Killers, was at Sundance.
Yeah.
And you were what, 23, 24?
23, yeah. 23. Something that I don't think would ever happen today. You know, it's like we made this small film for $100,000, shot it on 35mm, and submitted a VHS tape in the mail with just a wing and a prayer, just like, you know, like, hey, wouldn't it be neat if we got into that? And I did, yeah. I don't think that would ever happen now.
And well, because now they would know who you are.
That would be an immediate rejection.
Right? Yeah, it's like, man,
they made that mistake once.
they have their blacklist.
Yeah, exactly.
It consists of one name.
Yeah. It's a very short list.
Very short list.
Now, Alejandro, you went to film school in Cuba. Tell me about that experience. Because what age were you, and what brought you there?
Well, I lived in Cuba. It's not like I had a choice.
No, but to choose film school.
I always wanted to be a writer ever since like the moment when I was a kid and I learned how to write. I started writing stories, and I wasn't thinking about being a screenwriter. I just wanted to be a writer, and then somehow I landed on screenwriting. And then somehow I ended up going to film school to study screenwriting. And
it was great support for the arts in Cuba.
Back then, it was fine. I mean, back then, the film school was great. Things are not good now. Like, it's not even the film school, like anything. But
what kind of equipment did you have at the film school?
Oh, we used to shoot the shorts with these coconuts that we got from trees.
So did you shoot in
16mm, motherfucker?
All right, good.
You had to make a 16mm short, and then you had to make your 10-minute thesis in 35mm.
And then
you edited with some coconuts and some rocks.
And cellophane tape.
It actually had like a very good video library. I'm pretty sure you were blacklisted too.
Everywhere.
You mean they didn't have big ass spiders?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it was before that.
Yeah.
But Kiros probably was there, and we had like good teachers. I actually saw Blair Witch Project while I was at film school, and back then they didn't have internet at the film school, but I had back home, like super slow. But I read everything about it being like fake, but it was like right when it was coming out, and some people were still thinking it was true.
Right.
And I remember coming to school the next day, and everyone was still saying that really happened. So that was my intro to Ed Sanchez. Terrible. But it was a good experience, but it was essentially about writing. I didn't learn how to shoot. I learned how to shoot making movies.
Yeah,
I still haven't learned how to shoot.
Learn by doing. Well, Juan of the Dead was my first awareness of you, and maybe most of the world's first awareness of you, because I saw it at two film festivals, and it blew everybody away. And it was a huge festival hit, and a hit around the world. Box office, maybe not so much in the U.S. as in other countries, but it did well here.
It was a small release, a very small release.
Yeah, it was a small release, but it was a very unique movie. And it also has a great association with social commentary. You know, there's a lot of politics and social commentary in this very wonderfully silly movie that takes its zombies seriously.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, back then no one in Cuba did horror. And going back to film school, like, I was the kind of student, like, all other students were watching Bergman and Tarkovsky, and I was watching the movies that I grew up loving, the movies that made me want to be a filmmaker.
John Carpenter and Tobey
Hooper. I was watching Carpenter, I was watching Jaws, but I was also watching stuff like Polanski's The Fearless Vampire. vampire killers. Yeah. I saw that as a kid, and back then it freaked me out. And then I was like, no, this is a comedy. I saw Zombie 2. Movies that I had seen as a kid, and I only remember chunks. Like, I remember this. I had this image of Splinter going into a woman's eye. Yeah. What movie is that? And someone said Zombie 2. So, like, but
well,
it was like,
called Zombie 2 in other countries, not this one, because Dawn of the Dead was called Zombie.
Yeah.
Romero's. And so the producers, the distributors, distributed Zombie as Zombie 2, as a sequel to Dawn of the Dead.
So wait, here it was called Zombie?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, then I watched Zombie. So it was movies that I had seen as a kid and didn't even know the titles, but there were the movies that marked me. And obviously, I also had to watch the Berman and Tarkovskis, but like my day to day was like watching genre and horror movies, and no one had done a horror movie in Cuba really, but I've always been interested in social commentary. I think as artists, it's not that we have to, but we sort of have to think about it. It's our duty to try to say something, and the perfect blend of genres to say something was horror and comedy.
And Mike, what do you think reflects the Latino take on horror? Is it fed a lot by the Catholic Church and the sanguinary aspects of it?
I mean, we are very superstitious people. I mean, that is for sure. Certainly the Catholicism of it all, but certainly the Santeria, the different cult, you know, and you know, I think there's always
ceremonies.
Yeah, absolutely. There's just always been certain mysticism and certain gods and certain, you know, I mean, going back to the Aztecs. So I don't know why. And I really think there's quite a bit of great Latino filmmakers. We've always been kind of attracted to the dark and to the fantastic, whether it be Guillermo del Toro or Alfonso Cuarón, you know. And so I don't know if it's inherent in us, but I think we're just a bunch of superstitious people somehow, mm-hmm. or at least our culture certainly
no,
is.
But I do think, I think it's what Mike is saying. I think it's a continent that has a history of violence in many ways. I mean, the Aztecs, they had human sacrifices,
yeah, beheadings,
but
yeah.
Also you have in all these you have all these millennium cultures, like you also have like in Bolivia and Peru, all those places you have the Aymaras, the Quechuas, you have in Mexico, like those people built pyramids, they have massive cities, and they also have their religions, and then we were wiped by the Spanish, like, so that's part of the violence that runs in our blood. We were literally wiped by the Spanish, and then they brought slaves from Africa who also brought their religions, and they started to mix with the Catholic costumes, and that's how you have all the Afro-Cuban religions. You have the Macumba in Brazil, you have the Voodoo. Those are all mixes, and the violent history of Latin America continues in a way more political way, but all the 20th century has had a lot of that due to American policies mostly.
Yeah, well, having grown up in a country that was involved, affected greatly by American politics, but it's a communist country without sanctioned religion. So it's an interesting situation to grow up in. How did that affect your
It does, and now it has. They eased things up with the religions in the 90s when the Pope John Paul II came to Cuba. So after 1996, we had Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
I'm not joking. Before that, no one talked about Christmas. It's like it didn't exist. And after that, suddenly it's Christmas. But the Afro-Cuban religions have always been there and have always been like a very strong part of the Cuban day-to-day life. And it's not uncommon at all. Like people going to these Santeria ceremonies or even darker stuff. It's stuff that it's in your life. I'm half joking when I say to Mike, bring out the chickens. But I have...
Yeah,
it's the first job I ever did related to to film back in the 90s was camera assistant in a documentary, in a Spanish documentary about these religions, and I saw some animal sacrifices there.
Well, I remember being in Mexico City and going to a marketplace that was selling animals for sacrifices and all the devices and all of the implements that are used in these traditional ceremonies and rituals. And it was fascinating to me and seemed entirely Latin.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, I'm so, and like, I grew up in Bolivia because my parents, they were diplomats and they were there, and my mom's Bolivian. So they were diplomats there from the, since the 80s to the almost early 90s. And and you could buy in the street like stuff to make all the witchcraft that you needed. Like, for instance, I'm not making this up. When you're building a house or a building or something, they bury llama fetuses there. Oh. And suddenly you go, you're buying stuff on the street that you see like a bunch of like a, what do you call, like a kiosk?
Okay.
Or right, something with a bunch of llama fetuses there.
Wow, I did not know
well, those
that.
Things.
Yeah,
were
I'm gonna
in...
get you one. Yeah. If I ever go back to visit family, I'm gonna get you one.
Give me all the fetuses.
Bring
yeah,
one
absolutely.
Home.
Yeah, totally.
Just to make your house secure.
Yeah. But I was gonna say, like horror and genre stuff has just always been part of Latin cinema. Like, you know, whether it be the Santo films, whether it be El Vampiro, it's just Night of the Bloody Apes. It was just Latin cinema has just always been attracted to the.
Mexico has a great history of horror cinema.
Absolutely, and I think that's kind of what we wanted to tap into, is kind of like, well, that's kind of the origins of kind of Latin filmmaking. Like, we should kind of play with that and have fun with
it. Well, Gigi's really goes in for cultural
very much
investigation,
so.
Very much into a jungle Latin culture.
Yeah, she does a piece called Nahualis, which is about the Mexican shapeshifter, which is sort of like, you know, the Mexican werewolf. The idea was that everyone picked a monster or a creature from their Latin America neck of the woods.
For instance, we have the temerary Argentinian Rubik's Cube.
Yeah, it's just long lore. It's exact. Some people didn't stick completely to the assignment and, you know, said like, well, you know, portals and ghosty shit. That's close enough.
But it speaks to our traumas. Like, the man has never been able to put together a Cubik's room. Rubik's Cube.
Yeah. But yeah, no, Gigi really, really went for it. And I think that's one of the things that I really admire about her short, is that there's an authenticity that I couldn't do hers. You know, it's just, there's something that feels like this is a Mexican filmmaker talking about her culture, and even I could try, but it's just an approximation. There's something that felt very genuine about hers, which I think is really
because
cool.
Because she went to the actual small town or state or whatever where they do that kind of stuff.
The birthplace and of Mexican mysticism.
They even did like a ceremony, a ritual ceremony to bless
she would talk about how that they had these shamans to kind of protect them, and because there was these forest sprites that would apparently break lights, equipment would go missing and then be found somewhere else. Yeah. They'd hear voices. I seem to remember she would tell the story. Obviously, I'm just remembering what she said, but there was something that like some of the crew saw like the DP in a different room, and they yelled at him, and he went in, and then the DP entered through the other door behind them, going, "What are you guys talking about? Yeah. We just saw you," you know.
Whoa.
Yeah. So there's a bunch of stuff like that, and they said that they had to leave candy around for all the, you know, for all the forest sprites,
Good
and that
shit.
This is and that this is a thing.
By the
know?
Way, that's sometimes instead of chickens you use candy.
Right. It
depends on what you have, you know.
Yeah. Sometimes Skittles is the right.
No. I'm like, for real.
Yeah. No, I believe it.
Yeah. Since usually, but yeah, they had some weird things happening there. Yeah. And I think that you can feel that in the authenticity of her story.
When we were in Japan shooting Miike's episode of Masters of Horror, we started the shoot on the rooftop of the studio doing a Shinto ceremony to protect the production.
Wow.
And it was really fascinating.
Was that the first time that's ever happened, that you've been like in a prayer situation like that? Because I've never done that. I know a few filmmakers that have that are torn.
I'm gonna bring you to Cuba.
Okay. Yeah. Ghost sacrifices right before before for pictures up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So Ale, what's your story?
Mine is the Hammer of Zanzibar. It's a, again, We don't Based on Cuban legends. Yeah. I don't see. Let's see how I can tell this without spoiling it.
Yeah, no
It's
spoilers.
Actually... it's... I actually started telling you something before that was, I think, the very first spark to this idea. And I mentioned that I was like a camera assistant to these ceremonies for this Spanish documentary. And I remember while and I saw like really dark stuff. And like really like they had this huge altar and they were doing like this they sacrificed the chicken and then they brought a goat and they wrapped the goat's head to the men's crotches and the women's breasts and then they cut the goat's head and spilled the blood in an altar and then they pour rum on the severed neck of the goat and started drinking from that and passing it around. And I didn't. I was like, I told the producer, if they start passing that to us, I'm bailing. And so and it was like really, really intense stuff. And there was this old woman there, and she looked at me, and she said, "Are you part of this religion?" And I was like, "No." And then she said, "Then you cannot see this." And the rest of the night, I was like carrying cables and looking the other way.
Wow.
Because I'm like fucking superstitious. I don't know what can happen. And I didn't want to see. And there was also a moment where they requested that the filmmakers don't record something because it was secret. You have to think all these religions, they don't have like a written Bible. It's just mostly stuff that has been passed generation to generation. And they have their secrets. And the director told the DP to keep recording. Hidden. And I was thinking, what if you're not supposed to be recording? What if something bad happens if you record something that you're not supposed to see? And then because of that, it gets out. And that has been in my head for years. Like this was in 98, probably, I think. And since then, I've always wanted to do something with that. And eventually I came to this idea. I wanted to make a movie. A feature film. It's not different from my approach to our Nightmare Cinema story, where I like crammed a whole feature film in 20 minutes.
Yeah, you start in the middle.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So what I wanted to do was something. I was coming out of like a very hardworking experience, and I wanted to do something where I felt I could be like my dumb, unleashed me again. And I had this idea for a feature and I wanted to let my influences run wild. And one of my biggest influences has always been Tarantino and another one Sam Raimi. So I wanted that to be very clear. I wanted to tell a story in different chapters. And I wanted to do something that felt like you felt when you watch Evil Dead 2 for the first time, like those deadites that just are just insane. And then I one of the chapters was The Hammer of Zanzibar. And it was this super dumb idea based on a real demon called the Popo Bawa that really exists. You can look it up. It has a Wikipedia page and it's a demon from Zanzibar. And it's so stupid. Like when I read that years ago, like researching for demons, I was like, what the hell? Why hasn't anyone done anything with this demon? And, you know, it was lying there. So I said to Mike...
So it was your duty.
Yeah, it's like something... You leave something that stupid around me, I'm going to use it. And I said to Mike, I have this idea. I need you to talk me out of it. And Mike heard the idea and he was like, hell no, you have to do that.
No, do it.
And then
he wanted you to look stupid.
I know. Yeah. But then I talked to the other directors and they were the same. They were like, no, you have to do that. It's super fun. And I was like, oh, motherfuckers just want to see me burn.
No, it's great.
What it was,
you know, I think originally one of us had to do the wraparound. One of us had to take that duty and he was thinking about it. But the idea of Hammer of Zanzibar was kind of haunting him. And he's like, I'm going to get canceled if I make this. I shouldn't do it. You got to talk me out of it. And A, I didn't think it was that offensive that he was going to get canceled about it. So I was like, look, I think it's going to be fine. I think people will have a sense of humor and have a good time with it. But, you know, the important thing is that when you're doing a small independent anthology, this is the time to do the shit that no one else will do. This right. is the time that, like, no studio will ever make this. No, you know, no TV show will ever let me do
no
this.
No rules.
No rules. So that's the thing. We certainly don't have money, but what we do have is creative freedom. And we have the, you know, if there's ever a time to do the that risky one, like, I don't know how this is going to work. It's like, this is it, because there's not a lot of pressure. It's a low budget movie. It's fun. It's for the genre audience. And you know, I just felt like, let's go for it if we're going to do it. So I just absolutely wanted to encourage him to do it.
And by the way, the feature version, I remember I once pitched it to Sam, actually, to Sam Raimi, because I wanted to do something that felt like the Caribbean cousin of his Kandarian demon. And I wanted to call it like Mala Muerte, which was the Spanish title of Evil Dead.
Evil Dead. The Bad Dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, like, I had this chance. I knew that was never going to happen because they were making, like, real Evil Dead movies. And I did my condensed 20-minute version.
Well, it's great because, I mean, that's what you did on Nightmare Cinema with Thing in the Woods. And that whole experience was so great because everybody was able to do what they wanted to do. It was also a very low budget movie that there weren't overlords overseeing everything and testing everything with audiences and doing all of the shit you have to go through when there's more money at stake.
There's a joy in this, and that's 100% reason we got the filmmakers that we got. But both in Tales of Halloween and this was just like, look, there is no money in this. But, you know, we as filmmakers often get so frustrated from studio notes, from producers, from, hey, I know it's you're directing, but you kind of have to do this, or you kind of have to put this into it, and, you know, it changes our stuff. And I think all of us had been through an experience where it's just like, remember when we were kids and we just made movies for the love of making film because we wanted to make the films that we love? Like, let's go back to that. And you know, for better or worse, the only way you can do it is like, look, here's a very small budget, but you have complete autonomy. You can do whatever you want as long as it fits in the parameters of, you know, what we're doing here, you know, so.
Yeah, somehow we did that with Showtime and Nightmare and Masters of Horror and got all the great people, but it wasn't as low budget as the independent movies we're talking about. But it was still not a CBS NBC budget.
No, that's great.
But I was able, the selling point was, yeah, you can have these filmmakers, but you can't tell them what to do.
Right. Now, let me ask you, do you think you could do that now?
I would love to. We're trying. Clive Barker and I have an anthology
but
together.
But the same rules were with no interference, you think
the streamers seem to have gotten much more intrusive in the process. You would know best about that. In fact, producer Joe wrote a script with his partner Chris Lamont, and you directed it, and we haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, we haven't. And I don't know when we will. Producer Joe probably has better answers. I don't think. No, I don't know. I don't know.
This was for Netflix.
It was for Netflix, but it's not gonna be coming out on Netflix. Maybe I don't think. I don't know. They are allowing us to shop it around and hopefully find a good home for it. But like honestly, like I don't know. The industry is in such a weird moment right now that I wouldn't be surprised if they have to put it in tomorrow.
That's the hard thing about anything. I've been asking the question of like, you know, can you do that today? Like, who knows what we can do right now? The industry is in such a turmoil. Like, we know that none of these streaming services are sustainable. This business model isn't sustainable. You know, everyone's on strike. It's just like...
Yeah, they're losing billions of dollars and putting out movies, original movies, on the streamers like Disney Plus did with Hocus Pocus 2. What Peacock is doing with their Blumhouse releases and things like that. You know, Halloween ends, that sort of thing. So they're completely at sea with what they're doing. There is no guarantee to a box office success.
No, absolutely.
Like there used to be, even with franchises. Even the Marvel movies are doing less and less and less. Every movie that's been released this year by Disney has tanked.
Absolutely. And no one was expecting Barbie to be the biggest movie of the year, which I think is awesome. But I think
it's me
great.
Too. It's a pretty wonderful movie.
Yeah. But yeah, no, it's really good. But, you know, it really, it was that... Mission Impossible didn't do well, Indiana Jones didn't do well, and oh, the movie business is done, and then Barbie has the fourth biggest opening of all time.
One of the best times I have had in theaters in years has been the Barbenheimer experience.
Yeah. Right. But these are two original movies that are not, yes, it's one's based on a doll, but a toy. But these are original movies that aren't part of a franchise, that aren't something that is a comic book or something before. And they're killing, and they're really well-made, well-told stories.
I think, if anything, it just, to me, it showed that audiences want fresh stuff, they want new stuff, they want interesting things. We're done with the superhero thing.
And the studios
That they made 140 superhero movies, and then finally they gave a Latino one at the tail end of the whole thing.
Blue Beetle.
You know, Blue Beetle was great, and I'm very happy that they did. But it's kind of at the tail end as all this stuff.
I'm very happy that it exists, and this is something that we have been talking a lot about lately. There's a great output of Latino stuff right now. Like, you have Blue Beetle, you have our movie on the small horror corner. You have stuff like Flaming Hot on Hulu or Disney or both. So there's some Latinos doing stuff.
We just need people to come and see it.
That's the problem. It's like we have to get out there and go see and support the stuff that we're making. It's really hard.
Yeah, I'm working on a project with George Lopez myself.
Oh, cool. It was great in Blue Beetle.
Yeah, yeah.
You're so and much fun.
He's such an amazingly talented guy and a sweet guy. Really great. But anyway, what's your story, Mike?
My story, I because he did The Hammer of Zanzibar, then that kind of left the wraparound on me, which was a little daunting, you know.
No, back then, no, you're saying it wrong. I have so much better memory. That's why I know I wasn't the one that came up with this idea.
I could tell the story, but please tell me.
No. Like, because at that point, you were also thinking about doing a short before I had the hammer.
Absolutely, but that's the thing. You said I want to do the hammer, and therefore it was like, okay, well then I have to do the wraparound. That's kind of how I swear to God that's what happened.
No, because we settled on the wraparound when you brought up.
The production was very smooth.
Yeah.
absolutely no arguments.
When you talk, okay, start talking about the story, and I'm gonna tell you exactly the moment where I said that's the wraparound.
Okay, so I had an idea a long time ago, because sometimes, ideas come very strange. You know, sometimes it's a story and sometimes it's a character. And I always liked this idea of a character that was immortal, that had all the answers to everything, could play every instrument, knew all knowledge because he had been around eternally, but his immortality had a very high price, which is that death always followed him. And I won't say exactly what happens in my short, I'll leave it at that. But that was kind of just an interesting idea. And I always thought that would be like a supporting character in like a larger fantasy film or something like that. And then when we started talking about, the hammer, and then how we want to link Latin America and all the stories and all this mythology, I was like, this character actually would work for this because he has been around, he has traveled the world, so how can we take this character and then make him kind of our crypt keeper? And as you know, the wraparounds are a very important thing to an anthology.
I did the wraparound on Nightmare Cinema as well as doing Dead.
100%. And so I feel that in a lot of anthology films, it kind of gets neglected. And to me, it's one of the most important things. It's what leads us in the film, it what guides us through the film, and it's what we end with. So I felt, instead of doing the kind of thing where a crypt keeper tells a story to someone and then there's a big reveal at the end I felt like, what if the wraparound was a story itself, and what if we kind of traveled with this character and followed him all the way through, so that would carry us through the entire film. So that's how it came about.
And Ale, how do you?
I have a different version, but it ends the same. as far as I can recall, we started talking about like how the movie starts and all that, and then one day Mike mentioned this character that he had, and I said, Mike, that's it. That's the wraparound. But by then, he still was thinking about doing a short or something, and I remember I told him, if you do the wraparound, make that a short, because you're a make that a story, because you're not doing the wraparound and a short, because there's not like a lot of Latino filmmakers. We have to showcase as much as you can, and you're not taking two fucking spots, you right. fucking endless.
That could very well be. I don't remember that, but that could very well be. But, but certainly at some point it was kind of decided that yes, this
feels like something I would say to him.
Fair enough.
Yes, if he's yelling at me, so I'm like, God damn, don't be so fucking greedy, Mendez. That does sound like him. Yes.
Well, the world of independent film and filmmaking seems to never have been so complex as it is now, so difficult to get something off the ground, despite the fact there are so many more platforms. But tell me about how you went around pitching and selling this and ending up at Epic.
Honestly, I just have a very good relationship with Epic, and they've just always been very supportive. You know, it started with Big Ass Spider, then Tales of Halloween. If anything, I've always like wanted to make more films with them. There's a caveat. This is not a payday. You know, right, this is certainly right. What you get is the luxury of getting to make a film, and your film, and having a bit of autonomy to make the film you want to make. They've always been very kind to me and left me alone, because we've had a good experience. It's like Big Ass Spider went well, Tales of Halloween went well, so I think they feel, why should we get in the way, you know? And so with this, they saw the passion. They felt like, yeah, that is an angle that hasn't been explored. So they were on board and just very supportive. And
they were the first people you took it to?
Absolutely.
It was literally Mike said, we want to make an anthology called Satanic Hispanic. And it was, okay.
Yeah, no, it was really pretty quick. Yeah, no, it was.
Why don't I meet people like that?
But again, it really comes down to that we, I think, I don't know if we ever said it. I think we originally were like, we could probably do them for like $10,000 each. We didn't.
Don't tell them that. Yeah. So, don't ever tell anybody that.
Yeah, but it was always the idea that the filmmaker would just kind of go off and make their own thing. We wouldn't be on set. We just have to kind of sign off on the idea, and then you deliver us a finished product, and then that would be it. And that way. You know, like even when we were making Tales of Halloween in town, you just felt kind of guilty being on another director's set, kind of going, dude, we got to make the day, you know, yeah. And I'm like, he's my friend. I like him and I respect him as a filmmaker. I shouldn't be here. Like you find your own producer. You guys just give me a short. Okay.
Well, both of these movies, Tales of Halloween and Satanic Hispanics, is that sort of thing where make your movie, make your short, and we'll put it in our movie together.
Right.
Whereas Nightmare Cinema was a continuous production.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
yes.
It was more like Masters of Horror, doing one story, you end on Friday, and Monday the next story starts again with the same crew continuing.
Absolutely.
Other than the David Slade one, where we had to take a break.
We did ours together, but pretty much everyone else, you know, Demian's was shot
we're
in Argentina.
The only ones in town.
Yeah, exactly. We did ours because we were in LA, but Demian is in Argentina, so he did his there. Gigi, who lives in Canada, flew to Mexico. That was actually something we encouraged her, was like, because she had a problem. There was a huge snowstorm in Canada. And it's
something
like,
she's not used to.
Yeah, she's like, I don't know how to make this look like Mexico, and I've used every Mexican in Canada at this point. You know, I was like, I can't keep making Canada Mexico. And so I was like, well, why don't we, you know, I mean, it'd be a little more expensive, largely because we've got to provide security and things like that, but like, why don't you go to Mexico? And then she loved the idea.
Provide security.
Yeah, we absolutely did. Oh, absolutely.
We're that responsible?
Yes, that was the thing. It's like, we're not sending her out there on by herself, you know?
So well, but she's Mexican.
She had armed security that we,
really?
That we provided for her, yes.
Oh,
yes. So.
Good for us. Look at us. Thank you for our people.
It's a very, you know, sketchy part of the world there. So the only movie movie that had ever been shot there was Apocalypto. So I think Apocalypto and Satanic Hispanics only films ever shot in
Guatemala.
Dude,
it's Gigi. It's Gigi. She can take care of it.
No, I wouldn't want to mess with Gigi either.
I wouldn't want to be the guy that tries to mess with her.
Right.
Yeah.
But that was an exciting opportunity for her to kind of go back to her homeland. She'd never made a movie in Mexico, and it worked out great because, again, it adds to that authenticity. And then Ed Sanchez is in the Latino capital of the world, Maryland.
We didn't send security for him.
No, we did not.
Send weed.
Yeah.
So, Ale, you've worked in television and independent film and internationally, worked in Cuba and the like. So tell me your experience on doing American TV.
I mean, everything's the same, Mick. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter if you're making an indie film here or in Cuba or TV, when the clouds are coming and you have to run because you're going to lose the shot, you have to do it.
But From Dusk Till Dawn is a series of continuing characters and situations.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Is there a style book that you have to follow? Or
I mean, it has that Robert Rodriguez vibe.
Right.
So, like, every time I could come up with a shot that felt like Robert, I would go for it. And by the way, I stole one of my own shots from there for the Satanic Hispanics story. But you really had a lot of freedom. I recently had to rewatch the episodes, and doing Dusk was a fantastic experience. We had a lot of freedom. I mean, it's TV, so you have a lot of freedom as a director. It's not like you're going to be changing lines or so, but you know.
And just no time or money.
Well, no, but I learned to start shooting fast there. I also learned, like, I love the speed of TV where you're not wasting time. You don't see anyone sitting, not doing anything. You're constantly moving. You have to be respectful. But, you know, it's from Dusk Till Dawn. I went to take a picture in front of the titty twister and wear the cock gun. I got to direct Tom Savini.
Yeah.
That I remember that was... that was one of the few script changes that we did in his episode, and also I made a joke in his episode where one character shows a fake ID and I had the name be Eduardo Sanchez, and every time I see the name, I hear Tom Savini's voice saying Eduardo Sanchez. but it was fantastic. I had my cowboy hat. It was truly one of the best experiences I've had.
Well, what's interesting about it was that it was Robert Rodriguez's own television network, El Rey. I mean, he basically ran the
network.
And
his crew. It's the crew that has worked for him probably since From Dusk Till Dawn, the movie. A lot of people. And his own studio. Yeah. But it felt like a family, like people that were so used to working together and working with Robert, that like if you came up with a crazy set piece, they have seen way crazier stuff. And they were ready for it. Like, it was unbelievable. Like, that was a really well-oiled machine. Like, if you had to throw someone through a window, I would be shooting this angle, and then when I turned, they had already changed the window and placed the explosive and everything, because they are used to Robert like saying, why don't we do this?
Yeah.
So it was fantastic. It's truly one of the best experiences.
Robert, I think, is a big influence on this movie, too. I think all of us are kind of influenced by his stuff, or at least wanted to kind of get that kind of Latino action, fiery, you know,
and
kind
do it
of
yourself.
Vibe. Yeah, absolutely.
I have Robert DNA in mind for sure. Robert is also one of Gigi's biggest influences. So, yeah, he's absolutely there. Yeah,
absolutely. From Dusk Till Dawn, Desperado.
And, you know, other Latinos that we admire too, like, as Mike was saying, we had Norman Cabrera doing the monsters, and he has done great monsters for Guillermo del Toro.
So there was
a lot of respect and showing our influences.
Well, who were the people who inspired you to become a filmmaker in the first place?
Sam Raimi. I when I saw Evil Dead, that changed my life. I was 8 years old.
Wow.
Don't do that. And and Mala Muerte. And I remember it was one uncle of mine that brought it home. He usually brought movies, not necessarily that kind of movie. Sometimes he would bring stuff like Bruce Lee movies. Sometimes he would bring stuff like Deep Throat. I don't think I got to watch that.
Not at eight.
Back then.
I don't know about this uncle.
Yeah, right?
Well,
hey, wait,
now
that I think about it.
Tio Pablo was really nuts.
Popcorn on his lap.
Yeah. Well, it's Cuba. We didn't have popcorn. He did have a chicken on his lap.
Right.
But he brought Evil Dead, and that movie changed my life. And you know, you were talking about doing TV. Later, I got to meet Sam and work for him, pretty much like I did for Robert, doing his TV show, 50 States of Fright.
Right. Yeah. Right.
I've had a good run of working with people I admire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Mike, who were the ones who were your big influences?
Well, that's the thing, and there's a reason we click. It would be Sam Raimi, and Evil Dead 2 was the reason I wanted to make movies. And I kind of realized we had this bond when I was working on Nightmare Cinema, and, you know, I'm getting the dailies, and it's a woman running from a killer in the woods, and I'm like, do you see my Tales of Halloween? Because it's a woman running from a killer in the woods. He had much more time, much more money. It's a much more clever structure than what I did. But right off the bat, I was like, well, that's weird. And so.
And by the way, he also had an uncle.
Right. Yes. Jeremy Deep Throat. Not the movie, just how to. No, never mind.
Just anyway. The chicken. Yeah. Just the chicken.
Right. Exactly. But Evil Dead 2 was my film school. That's what I watched in high school. That's what, like, because there was something, because he was kind of the ultimate do-it-yourself independent filmmaker with Evil Dead, there was something that you could watch and you could learn from it. You go, how did they do that? And there was no internet then. You'd have to find magazines or books so you'd learn about the shaky cam. You know, it's like, it's like, oh, it's a 2x4. They do that. And how'd they do the shot where they ran through the car and through the window? And it's like, well, they had like a battering ram. And so you would do all these research and stuff like that, and you'd figure it out. And then, you know, thankfully, when I was starting out, I mean, I did a little of Super 8 stuff, but, you know, we had like high 8 cameras. So they're small and compact. So we could kind of do these kind of things with the cameras and put them in odd places above and over, you know, ceiling beams like Sam did. And so it really kind of be, I mean, we were all that eyeball shot, right? The famous, like, you know, attach the eyeball to the camera. Everything when I was in high school was like, how can we, you know, make this arm fly in the air and do the Raimi shot, you know? It was a shorthand for me and all my friends, was the Raimi shot, shaky cam, a fake Shemp, all of these things. And so, again, I think Raimi, and you know, I'm sure I'm not the only one to say this, or Alejandro's not the only one to say it. I think he influenced generations of indie filmmakers, you know?
I mean, I didn't have those. In Cuba in the 80s or 90s, like, I wasn't even dreaming about being a filmmaker. All the stuff that Mike's saying, like, I didn't have Super 8. I didn't have any of that.
You
I
had was coconuts, just though.
Yeah, I had coconuts. No. I was like, Mike was figuring out how to put an eyeball in a camera, and I was listening to my uncle tell how you steal a chicken by putting a finger out its ass.
Well, on Nightmare Cinema, you were using drones and things.
Not drones. Like, the Raimi shot was the spider POV that we
spider did. Cam.
Arachno cam. Because Arachno I remember I was saying that I wanted to do that shot like Sam Raimi did this shot in Evil Dead, and then Howard Berger said, oh, we got the guy that built Sam his rig. Well, he's going to build you something. And they did. And he said, and if Sam had this, he would call it something like Arachno cam. So that's what we had. When we got to that day, it was like, bring out the Arachno cam.
And it was fantastic.
I wonder what that is.
It works out.
By the way, I have the splitting head.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
They gave you the splitting
head? Yeah. Howard told me, like, I got something for you, and he had the splitting head, and now it's in my closet, and my kids don't know what is that thing that's covered there that I said, don't ever...
Don't look at that.
Don't ever touch that.
Well, Howard and Greg are two of the great guys, the guys from KNB, Howard Berger and Greg Nicotero, just... wonderful artists and wonderful humans. So, this is going to be in theaters?
It is. September 14th,
it's a miracle. The chickens worked.
Yeah, totally.
What are you going to do opening night?
We're still trying to figure it out. We might either...
We're Latinos, Mick. All is very organized. You can see that there's always been a plan. So like 2 weeks from opening, we're like, so what are we gonna do tonight?
Yeah, because it's opening. We've never had this problem where it's opening all over the city, and we're just like, we don't know what to do. Wow. We don't know where to go. So I don't know if we're gonna like break up and like, since it's an anthology, like different anthologies have different screenings. Like we wanted Hammer of Zanzibar and Sherman Oaks.
We wanted to do it together, but the last time we watched a movie together, there was an incident with a bucket of popcorn
and a chicken. So Mike
was like, let's do separate theaters. I don't think he wants me around again. So he's like, I can bring friends and do the Traveler Theater, and you can do the Hammer of Zanzibar Theater. And by the way, the Hammer of Zanzibar Theater is way more fun than the Traveler Theater.
Probably. I think I'll be
all
at
buckets,
City.
All buckets of popcorn.
I think I'll be at City Walk, and I think he'll be at the Regal.
We're not sure. By the way, it's like we're saying all these, we're still not sure. Yeah, we're trying to figure it out.
And I believe we'll be at the Alamo Draft House on Sunday for a Q&A.
But it's not confirmed. Not confirmed.
I'll do one that are confirmed. Okay, Friday the 15th, I will be in Santa Ana at the Frida Theater.
I'm gonna be in Santa Ana with
you. We'll be both doing a Q&A. That's right, you're joining me. Somehow I got suckered in on Saturday to drive to Fresno for the Galaxy Theater in Tulare, California, my favorite theater.
And
I will be doing a Q&A because he was smart and said no.
I have kids. I have kids. I cannot.
That's right.
I mean, I do want to bring my kids to Fresno.
It's always been a dream. Yeah.
Well, I love the fact that the sense of humor that you guys both possess is so well reflected in the movie. Both of you've got the funny ones in the show. Dumb shit. But you guys have the funny episodes, and they're really genuinely funny and find such humor in great places and unexpectedly so. And the movie's terrific, and I thank you for sharing your experiences here and wish you all the best of luck. And everybody on the September 15th, go out and see.
Yes, please do.
Satanic Hispanics.
Please go.
If who's going to support us if other Latinos and other horror fans don't come out and do it? We want to make more of this stuff and want more of this stuff to exist. But obviously,
Look at it this way. The film's opening September 14th, kicking Hispanic Heritage Month. But there's no Satanic Heritage Month.
Oh, there
let's
needs
go
to
for
be.
It.
Absolutely.
Let's make it a tradition. Yeah. Let's also kick that one.
Every year, Satanic Hispanic, coming up.
So yeah, let's go for it.
Yeah. Totally.
Mike Mendez, Alejandro Brugues, thanks for joining us on the slab.
Thank you,
Mike.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday, or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Postmortem with Mick Garris is produced by Mick Garris and Joe Russo. Our sound engineer is Christopher Leon Price. Our announcer is Jeff Gelb. Our graphic designer is John Holland. And our theme was composed and performed by Bill Burney with additional music by John Jasensky. If you're enjoying our show, please take a moment to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.